On today's episode of The Good Word, Russ Bengston joins us to talk about sneakers, basketball, and myth-making as he talks about his new book. That and much more on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports, Ball Don't Lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie Network. Get us wherever you're getting your podcast, and we are also on YouTube. If you are on YouTube, you see the man with the beard, and I am not talking about myself. I am talking about an author of A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. He's a former editor-in-chief of Slam Magazine. He's also a longtime sneaker editor of Complex. The man himself, Russ Bengston. Russ, how you doing this morning, man?
Thank you so much, Vincent. I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Very well.
This is pretty cool. Like, for one, like, anybody who's read Slam for a number of years, I was out also like a guest, a freelance writer when I was in college. I wrote a few features for Slam. It's like the Scoop Jacksons and Ben Osborns and Lang Whitakers. Yeah. And Russ, like all of you guys, it was a niche almost when it started in the mid-90s, even before we get to the sneakers, but it just feels like a natural progression to go from Slam to the book. Did you guys feel like you were doing something like special and groundbreaking when you guys were doing it?
I think we knew to an extent, you know, and I think it came from like different sides, you know. It's like from the way the players reacted to us, or actually the way like some of the more mainstream media reacted to us. You know, I think we knew we were doing something different. It was always funny where someone would try and like kind of talk down to us by calling us fans. And it's like, well, yeah, we're fans. Like, that's part of the point of all this. Like, you know, I don't think we were afraid to necessarily call people out for things. But at the same time, it's like, well, yeah, of course, we're basketball fans. Like, that's why we do this. So I don't know. I don't think we ever saw that as the same negative. You know, it's like we weren't doing the same job, obviously, the beat writers were.
Right.
And obviously, we had respect for a lot of those guys, you know. And I think, like, some of it was funny where it was like a game would end and we wouldn't jump right in with questions because it's like, well, we know these guys have to get their job done. And maybe sometimes it would look like, oh, well, these guys are just coming into the locker rooms to hang out. And it's like, nah, like, we know you guys have jobs to do, like, and we have jobs to do too. And the way we do them is different from the way you do them. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think we were aware we were doing different things. And it's kind of funny now to see, like, you know, and Allen Iverson talk about, like, the way the media was when he was playing. And part of me wants to be like, Allen, not us, right?
Part of it, yeah. And it's funny. It wasn't like you guys were just, you know, fans. It was, you guys had interviews with the biggest names. It was like, it became like you and AI became sort of synonymous, but you guys had a great relationship with Michael Jordan. You guys had a great relationship with Penny Hardaway. You guys had a great relationship with everything through the culture, not necessarily, you know, one relationship or another. And I always found it interesting that, yeah, like when I was a newspaper writer, yeah, everything was important that day, like the game that day. But when you're writing for a magazine, it is literally 30,000 feet. You're literally having to get quotes about something that has nothing to do with today. A lot of times those guys would be a lot more open. They would be a lot more open because they weren't worried about gotcha quotes, and it wasn't, you know, Twitter or anything like that back then. It just seemed like a very like special, special time for basketball culture as a whole. And that's where I kind of want to start with your book, A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. Because when, you know, when you're thinking about it, when I was thinking about it before I read it, I was like, okay, let me guess what sneakers are going to be on here. Let me figure out, what I mean? Let me figure out if every era is going to be sort of captured. So I guess the first question would be, Russ, what was the process like in selecting the 15 sneakers? Was it, let me capture every era, let me capture every evolution, or was it, these are the 15 sneakers that best encapsulates basketball?
It was, I mean, honestly, it was a combination of a bunch of things. And I think, like, you know, there were some super obvious ones, right? Like, especially, like, if you go from the early 1980s back, there's only so many you can choose. So it's like, you know, the Chuck Taylor was obviously going to be the starting point. the Superstar Pro Model, the Top 10, the Air Force One, like those were, even the Air Jordan One, like I feel like those were almost like givens where it's like, well, I kind of have to do these, like these move the story forward. Like, and these were clearly significant shoes in their own way and remain so. And then it gets later and that's when it starts to get tough. You know, you get into the 90s and I feel like Air Jordan was really what helped open up this basketball sneaker world to all these different brands and all these different signature models. You know, then it gets more difficult. And yeah, I mean, some of it was definitely about not wanting to have too big a gap in years, right? Like, I don't want to skip from 1989 to like, or from like 1985 to 1995 and then do like five shoes that all came out around 95, 96, which I could have.
Right.
And then like have to scramble to get to present day or as close to present day as it was. I mean, the AdaptBB was closer to present when I pitched the book than when it got published. And certainly when I wrote the book, even it started to like, oh man, do I need to add a 16th? So yeah, I mean, some of that was like, I think in my initial list, I actually had three pairs of Jordans. Like I wanted to do the one, the three, and the 11. And it kind of came to like, wait, if I'm only doing 15, and I mean, obviously I touch on a lot more shoes than those 15 in the book. I can't dedicate three chapters of 15, like a fifth of the book, to just Jordans. I'm as significant as all that stuff was. I definitely wanted to work in different brands. You know, like there was definitely a conscious thought to get in the Pump, to get in the Curry. And obviously, I think those have compelling stories too. One oversight I did early on, and I still remember, like, I was literally at my storage unit. I picked something up. I was getting in my car and I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't include a women's shoe. And it's like, this was like, just like a complete, I was just so caught up in like era stuff or whatever.
Right, I'm like,
I have to put the Swoops in. And I initially wanted to include, and I talk about the shoe in the book, like the Swoop Zoom, which was like, I believe her third shoe. That was like my favorite of the line. And that was my initial thought, like, oh, I'm going to include this. And the more I dug into Swoops and Cheryl's story, it's like, wait a minute. No, it has to be the first one.
Right.
And then, you know, it sort of became at some point like kind of a domino effect where it's like you include one thing and that shoe tells a certain story. Well, you don't want to include another shoe that sort of overlaps. And it's also like you put one in, you have to take one out. So, you know, because I think initially when I pitched it, and I would even have to look back to my proposal, but like initially it was fewer. It was either 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I started kind of figuring out what shoe did what, I'm like, oh man, like this is too few. I'm going to have to skip too much. And then once I got over 15, it's like, well, this starts to get silly. It's like, do I even want to include a number? Then it's just a history of basketball and sneakers. And like, I don't know, that leaves too open for me. Right. Like I would have never finished it. So 15 became the sweet spot. And it's like, yeah, I mean, there's ones I regret leaving out, you know, like I'm glad I touched on the ones I did, but it would have been so easy to do like, I don't even know how many different ones that unfortunately didn't make it.
But you know what's funny, Russ? Because I like the way that you structured the book. Like, it is a book for people who love sneakers and people who watch this on YouTube. They can see behind me. If they know a little bit about me, I love my shoes. I love my sneakers. You know, I'm big into the original colors of retros and everything else. And that's just me.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The book itself, you're telling multiple stories. You're not just focusing on the 15 sneakers. You're focusing on the history of basketball, like the evolution of the game. You're focusing on the players who wear the shoe and the evolution of how players got to wear the shoe. And you're also focusing in on the promotional campaigns with basketball, with the NBA. And I think that's something that's gotten a little lost. Like, people are wondering why the NBA isn't as good as promoting its players like it appeared to be during the quote-unquote golden era of the 90s. And I tell people all the time, it wasn't that the NBA was promoting its players. Nike was promoting the players with their shoes, and right. it just became more synonymous. Like, you think of the names of the 90s, you think of Jordan and Barkley and David Robinson, and all, they had Nike commercials. It just became one and the same. And I think the shoes back then, because it felt more, I won't say the word is more unique or more groundbreaking, they felt like they were more telling a story about the individual player, like the Jordan 3, which I think is, if you can see behind me, that is one of my like yeah. three favorite shoes of all time. And I'm a Detroiter. I hate Michael Jordan and all that, but the Jordan 3 is one of my favorite shoes of all time, right? Like, it just, the elephant print and everything else, it just tells a story. And I know that you know so much about shoes, but just curiously, what did you learn? What details did you learn once you started digging in about shoes and about the culture that you already had a pretty good handle on?
I mean, there's a lot, you know, and, you know, there's still so much I don't know. You know, it's like, unfortunately, like, and I feel like that's how it works with research on anything, is like, the deeper you dig, the more you realize, like, there's so much more out there that you don't necessarily know about. You know, I guess one easy thing, like, so initially I had pitched like chapter two, whatever, as the superstar and the pro model, because I couldn't separate the two. Mm-hmm. And digging into that and, you know, talking to the creator of the shoe, it's like the whole concept behind that shoe was to do a low cut. And the only reason the pro model exists is because they realized like some players weren't going to want to wear a low top basketball shoe. So, you know, I kind of had it in my mind going into it that the superstar was like a takedown or a cut down version of the pro model, while it was kind of the opposite, and that the pro model was a built up version of the superstar. So, you know, that definitely surprised me a little bit. And it's also interesting just to look at like, and it's dependent on looking at all this stuff together, you know, where you had something like the top 10 and the 10 players and the Air Force One. And that was kind of for, you know, all the top line Nike guys, and how that became kind of a, let's make a shoe for this group of people. Mm-hmm. And Air Jordan was, you know, kind of took that and turned it on its head, where it's like, no. One guy, one shoe. And I think if you look at a lot of that stuff and what you brought up with David Robinson and Penny Hardaway and like Charles Barkley, like a key to so many of those shoes was like, you needed like a dope player who like fulfilled the promise. You needed a really cool looking shoe, and even something that, you know, maybe people didn't even love right away, but it had to be like, oh my God, what is that? And then you needed those commercials. You know, you needed them to become larger than life. Like, as good as a player was, you needed that extra little spice on top.
You need the imagination there.
Yeah.
I mean, that imagination.
The Air Jordan 3, like, it comes out in 88. Jordan wins everything that year. He's MVP and Defensive Player of the Year and All-Star MVP, Dunk Contest Champion. But, like, if you look at the Air Jordan 3 and Michael Jordan, what you remember is probably the Spike and Mike commercials, right? Like, the black and white Mars Blackman stuff. Like,
yep.
That just added that so much of a higher level, where it's like, you know, there were guys before who won a lot, like, okay, not that much, although like Magic and Bird won titles in those years, and like I don't think their peak years are even like thought of in that same way as 88 for Jordan, because like he had that added extra, he had that Whiten and Kennedy Magic on top of it. And that's not to take away from what Magic and Bird accomplished, or, you know, going back like Kareem and Wilt and Bill Russell. But from a full-on fan consumer perspective, like, you know, that extra matters. And I think what bothered me, like, as I got kind of to the end of the process and doing this book, like, companies don't really do that anymore. You know, you get a little bit, and I think like some of it can be blamed on fragmentation and social media, and people aren't watching things the way they used to. But it's like, man, where's the cool, like, amazing sneaker NBA All-Star Game commercial? Where's the sneaker Super Bowl game commercial? You know, like, I feel like companies have kind of seeded the idea of like creating mythologies to just like well, let the players perform and put the shoes on the shelf and what happens, happens. And it's like, no, that, but that's not the way really it ever worked.
No, that's something that I've talked about, bemoaned all the time. Like, it literally, I want to say, and I could be missing a couple of commercials, but the Air Force One, maybe it was the 25th anniversary of the Air Force One, and you had a bunch of guys in a commercial. They were like in a hangar, and it was like the ultimate pickup game. You know what I mean? Like, that was, I felt like, was the, like, LeBron was on one side, Kobe was on another side. Like, every Nike name was in there. They had, I want to say, maybe it was Joel Santana rapping. Like, it was an excellent spot, right? And I felt like it kind of ended, like, right there. Maybe there was a couple of other commercials that I'm missing. I think maybe LeBron, when he won his first championship, Nike put out a commercial with Marvin Gaye singing, and that was really cool. And maybe when Kobe won his fourth one, I think they had something with Andre 3000, but that was like 2009, 2012. So it wasn't necessarily too far after. I feel like you said, the imagination has been kind of lost. And you made an important point that I think maybe gets lost, because today's kids, they just grab the shoes. If they see the shoes, it's on the sneakers app, they grab them, it's in freaky colors and everything else. But you made the point that the stories aren't told about why a particular shoe was important, why it's tied to this player, why it's tied to this particular moment in history. A lot of people are left to assume or have to do their own research, as opposed to, hey, this is why this thing is called classic. Like, we just assume that it's classic.
Right.
Or people my age tell people my brother's age, this shoe was important, and that's probably not how it should be.
Yeah, and like, on top of that, you know, I think, like, I certainly don't intend the book to be a checklist, right? Like, I don't think, like, I'm not saying, like, oh, everyone should own these 15 shoes. Like, I don't own all 15 of those. I have owned a lot of them, you know, like, there's a couple in there. Like, I never had a pair of Swoops. I wanted the Swoops Zoom, but didn't get them. I don't think I definitely didn't have a pair of Air Force Max back then. You know, back then it was like, well, it's this or that. So, like, my hope is a little bit is that when people read the book, like, I think they should ask themselves, like, why aren't shoes today getting this same treatment? You know, like, what is going to be like the classic of tomorrow? Is it going to be the same shoes forever? You know, like, 100 years from now, when people are talking about sneakers, are they going to have the same shoes on the wall as you do behind you now? You know, like, is it going to be those same 10 years or 15 years for eternity? And like, it shouldn't be. Like, and I don't think it's even necessarily a case of modern stuff being bad. I think it's modern stuff not getting the same chance or not being treated the same way. You know, like, I don't think it's a case of like a Ja or a KD15 or a Curry 11 being a bad shoe. It's just like, but where's the other stuff to go with it? You have a great player. The product's cool. What's the incentive? Like, where's the myth making? And it's all being left up to the consumer. And it's like, yeah, but if you do that, the consumers are going to buy the old stuff because the old stuff had that. And I think we see that where like a new retro drops, Jordan 1 reimagined notwithstanding, and it just disappears. And meanwhile, something new comes out. It maybe gets pushed for a day. It gets like a social media post or two, and then it just sits on the shelf until the next one comes out. You know, and that's kind of a shame. Like, I think some new stuff is actually pretty good. I've kind of, you know, gotten myself to like, look, like, where the current stuff? Right. The current stuff's all that's new now. So like, when we did the book drop in New York City on launch day, like, I bought a pair of Tatums for that. And like, honestly, I think that shoe's really good. You know, it's a $120 shoe. Like, that's still pretty incredible. Like, I didn't really play in it. I shot around a little bit at Rucker, which was nice. But, you know, that shoe is like way more technologically advanced than any retro you'll buy. And it's cheaper than most retros. And it's current.
Like, the crazy thing is, the retro market has gotten so, you know, whether it's StockX or eBay or whatever, like, all these shoes, if you don't get them on release day, there's a chance you might have to pay double to wind up getting them compared to the performance shoes that are on the market that maybe don't give you the same nostalgic feel because they're a new shoe. There's no nostalgia attached to it. But functionally, it's a good shoe. There's multiple ways that we can take this conversation, but I want to take it further back because I feel like with the Air Jordan phenomenon, a lot of people were saying in hindsight, damn, why didn't I do that? You know what I mean? Like Magic and Bird, right, maybe particularly right, Magic right. was like, wait a minute, how did this just happen on my watch? And was that, in your opinion, that was something like a supernova that happened with the right player at the right time? He came from North Carolina. He had David Falk. And then you had Nike, which was not a basketball sneaker, honestly. You know what I mean? Like that was not Field Knight's thing. And then they made their foray into basketball. Was that just right place, right time, right player? Or did other players miss the boat and this phenomenon could have started a little bit earlier?
I think like it kind of ties into something I figured out again, like as I was working on this thing. And it's like, I feel like if you look backwards at history, you could always say like, oh man, like why didn't this happen earlier? Or why didn't someone else do this? But it's like, you kind of have to go back and put yourself in all these people's shoes and look at it as it hasn't happened yet forward. And it's like, you know, even David Falk, who was a pretty terrifying guy to talk to for a long period of time. Like David Falk is a very forceful personality. Let's say that.
Very much so. Very much so.
You know, he came out and said like, look, nobody knew how successful this was going to be. And if anyone says that, they're lying. And it's like, to me, like the reason it succeeded is certainly the reasons you state. I mean, Jordan like came in and was the most compelling player in the league, but Nike put kind of a lot of capital behind it. Nike had a lot of, you know, they were in trouble if Air Jordan didn't work. So it's like they had to do everything in their power to make it succeed. You know, you had a case where like instead of a shoe just like being released or being slowly adopted by basketball players, like they built up demand for this thing, you know, through all these ads and the band commercial and like, you know, Jordan starts wearing it in November and it doesn't release until April. Like they made sure it was going to work because, again, if it didn't work, they were in a lot of trouble. So they kind of were forced to believe in it, even if they weren't so sure. You know, Jordan comes out, has an incredible rookie season, enters the slam dunk contest wearing his own stuff. Like, you know, they kind of like, they put in so many fail safes. And to me, like, yeah, like Converse could have done it with Magic, technically. Like Magic had the smile, Magic had the game, Magic had LA. But I mean, Converse never believed in that. They didn't believe in the idea of like giving one guy his own shoe. Even after Air Jordan, as successful as that was, it sells $126 million worth of product in a year. When like their out was like, if it doesn't sell 5 to 7 million, even after that, like Converse put out the weapon, right? But the weapon was that the colors were maybe like reflective of Air Jordan a little bit in that doing team colorways, and it wasn't just a white shoe with a logo and a team color. But they still hedged their bets. You know, they didn't make it the Magic Bird shoe. They didn't make it the Magic shoe. They put everyone in those commercials. They did like a few with just Magic and Bird, but like the one everyone remembers for good or for bad reason is the rapping commercial. You know,
oh, the
which
rapping
is like
commercial
Magic,
is so fun.
Bird,
the rapping commercial
Isaiah,
is so fun. McCann.
I'm saying, but it was like they hedged their bets. It's everybody. And it's like the idea that a company like that with multiple MVPs still felt like they had to do it that route, you know, after the success of Air Jordan from a rookie, you know, they were still like kind of so set in their ways. And, you know, yeah, like, okay, what if Magic, you know, I guess you could go back to like, what if Magic signs with Nike in 1979 instead of Converse? But like in 1979, Nike didn't have the product. You know, there wasn't the same commercial infrastructure. Like part of it was a matter of timing, you know, and like I think you go to like David Stern taking over as commissioner around the same time Jordan comes into the league, you know, TV deals changing, like the perception of the NBA changing, like there were so many aspects that made that work. You know, I don't think you can just say like, well, if someone else tried it, it would have worked. And I think the other side of it is like, when it did happen and it did work, you had a lot of brands be like, oh my God, like if Nike could take one guy, a rookie, and build an entire basketball program around him through one shoe, we can do that too. And I think like, I don't know if companies learned. They might still not have figured this out, but like, it wasn't like another company could come in and duplicate Air Jordan. It's not like someone else could come out and sell $100 million worth of product, because Air Jordan still exists. It still existed then. Like, you know, I think, and I talk about it a little bit, you know, I think Adidas found that out the hard way. Like, they signed Patrick Ewing the next year and put this big push behind Patrick and like all this different product and like the Conductor and the Rivalry, like they were really cool shoes. But it's like, you're not releasing that into a world that's waiting for something like that to happen. You're releasing that into a world that has embraced Air Jordan. Like, you either need to convert some of those people, you know, or hope that your market, whether the Adidas market or the New York market, like goes full on into it. Like, I think they were like, they kind of diluted themselves a little bit. And I think a lot of other brands did too.
And the crazy thing was, Russ, I feel like after, because Michael was straight Madison Avenue, you know what I mean? He had the perfect smile. He had the perfect machine behind him at the time. And the only thing that was kind of, I felt like, was going to break through after that was going to be something counter. Right? Whether it was going to be Charles Barkley, I'm Not a Role Model, or the Fab Five with the Huarache. Like, it had to be something that was counter, but still had enough of a machine behind it. But the machine was telling you, I am not Michael Jordan. I am something different, but I am just as cool. And that's where I think you feel like there's a straight line, at least in my opinion, between where the Charles Barkley Air Force Max, the first one, or the second one, I guess, the second one, the one that the Fab Five wore. And then Huarache, which came out a year before. And then Allen Iverson comes along, at first wearing Jordans and then wearing Reeboks once he got to the NBA, where counterculture became like the word of the day as opposed to trying to follow the Jordan model. Is that something that you saw a straight line with?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think, like, you know, in the beginning, in the very beginning, I think Jordan himself was kind of counterculture, where it's like, but counter to like mainstream culture as a whole, like not with basketball. And then he kind of became like the main guy. So it's like, how do you play off that to do something different? You know, I think, like, and he was to a degree, and again, the question is one of the shoes, like, I wish I could have gone longer on in there and didn't, but like, you know, that was kind of like doing Air Jordan the second time, you know, like doing Air Jordan for kind of the generation who grew up watching Air Jordan, but were ready for the next thing. And that's kind of where Reebok entered in and where Iverson entered in. Although I think even by then, things were changing. You know, things were a little bit different. And again, Air Jordan was 11 shoes deep at that point, and like everyone basically was like a banger. So it's like, and right after that, you get into retro and everything else. So like making it even harder to make that kind of an impact. You know, and for Nike, it's like, I think with Penny and Barkley and those guys, it was just diversifying. You know, it's like, okay, everyone's not going to buy Air Jordan. Like, what other different things can we do? Who else can we have take off like this? You know, I think the Fab Five were like a perfect thing, and like even ahead of their time, where it's like you had a group of college kids, like, you know, sort of driving things instead of just following along and wearing like whatever the brand wanted them to wear. You know, they were more like, no, give us that. Like, we know better than you do. And the thing is, they kind of did at that point. You know, I think like, and I think that's what made some of that era really good and sort of hard to duplicate now, where it's like, you had brands creating stuff and then right away, people getting into it who maybe weren't even the intended, like, audience, market for it.
Yep.
You know, I think you look at something like the Flight Huarache, and, you know, that shoe was built as this like sort of speed, like, you know, minimalist shoe. And it ends up being worn by like Chris Webber and Juwan Howard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of going in a different direction and maybe appealing to a market that they didn't even think about right away.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I wear that shoe now. Like, that's probably one of my favorite basketball shoes, period. It's not on the wall because it's in my closet. You know what I mean? Like, like, not just the basketball shoe, but the cross trainer and everything. Like, if Huarache came out in the winter boot, I'd buy it. You know what I mean? Like, it's that level fun shoe for me. But I think about, as it fast forward, I think about the Zoom generation, LeBron's first shoe, and then Kobe getting his own shoe years later because he started with Adidas, and then he had his own, you know, he had the rape allegations and everything else that made him toxic to go to. And then he got with Nike, and then he got his own shoe. And then Steph, I felt like they all kind of followed a similar sort of model. Like a LeBron, I felt like in a way we knew him before he knew us, if that makes sense. And I felt that created the LeBron phenomenon, even though I don't think his shoes resonate with people, at least my age, the same way that they did, the same way that an Allen Iverson line would have, the same way that a Barkley or a Penny line did. Do you find it harder to get that connective tissue with today's culture and today's players? Is that the marketing, or is that just something else that we're not able to see and quantify?
I think I still think a lot of the difficulty is just the ubiquitousness of Air Jordan and the idea that, you know, Jordan is kind of the pinnacle and has stayed there. And even the idea that, like, a lot of that stuff from, like, I don't know what the sweet spot is, you know, I would say later than 85, but I always go with 85 because that was Air Jordan 1,
mm-hmm.
you know, into probably the early 90s remains the most wearable stuff, right? It's when they were still using leather. It's like, they weren't like overlasted. They weren't like super giant air bubbles or crazy weird heel technology, whether it be shocks or something else. You know, it remains the most wearable stuff. And the Jumpman, you know, has kind of become, as predicted by like everyone from Peter Moore to Tinker to Falk to, you know, Howard White, it's become this symbol. You know, it has become like the Mercedes, you know, triangle, or the BMW, or the Ferrari prancing horse. Like, it's kind of separated itself from Michael Jordan and become its own thing. So it's like, when you're creating a new product now, I think back then it was almost easier in a way, where it's like, you know, there was a challenge in succeeding something that was extremely popular. You know, I'm sure for Tinker, coming up with the Air Jordan 4 after the success of the 3 was like, oh man, like, what do we do? But at the same time, it's like, but the 3 is going off the market. You know, maybe people won't like the 4 as much as they like the 3, but if they want the new Air Jordan, well, this is what the new Air Jordan is. You can either buy it or you can buy something else, but like, this is it. Now, every shoe that comes out not only is competing against like its previous design, but so much of the past is just still readily available, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be on the resale market or like, I mean, you look at the Jordan release schedule now, it's insane. Like, I see like a season's worth of stuff and it's like, wait a minute, 20 years ago, that was like your entire year, if not more.
Yep.
You know, so I look at something at like the Air Jordan 38 or the LeBron 20 or the KD 15, like they're kind of being set up to fail because it's like, okay, here's this new product. And like, yeah, you're probably not going to like it right away. You know, you're going to have to get used to it. But the thing is, you can skip over that now. You don't have to. Back then, it's like, yeah, I don't really love the LeBron 2, but it's the new LeBron. I'm going to buy it.
Right.
And now it's like, I don't know if I like this. Oh, there's 2 different Air Jordan 12s out right now. I'll just buy that instead. So like, people don't even give the new stuff really a chance.
It's not a chance.
You know,
to
you don't buy it and sit with it. Yeah. Like, I was in a Foot Locker or a JD Sports the other day, and I was looking at those, and I forget whether they're I think they're the Aunt Pearls, but like the pink KD 15.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is actually a pretty cool shoe. Like, it's got all the embossing and like, it does have all like the little details that like a modern signature shoe should have. But it's like, who even gets to that? Who even gets to that shoe? Like, as to your point earlier, people are buying stuff off like push notifications on their phone. You know, it's like they're saying like, oh, I want this. Let me know when it releases. I'll try for it. And then as all of us know who buy shoes, you know, if you don't get it and it sells out, you literally get an email from StockX 5 minutes later being like, we have this. And it's like, yeah, it's probably 300 instead of 150. But
right.
Oh, well, if you really want it, that's how you get it. So like, how many consumers never even get to the point now of like looking at the new stuff? You know, I feel like a lot of it just like blows by. Like, I feel like if you quizzed like whatever the average basketball age consumer was on like what model number guys were up to, I don't know if they would know like half of them. Like, I don't think it just doesn't register anymore. Like, I know like Jordan pushed the 38 a little bit when it first came out, but it's like, do you know anyone who has them? I don't.
No, I think the last one that I got, Russ, this, I might be giving away some game, but I think a buddy of mine at Nike or Jordan Brand sent me the 35s. And the only reason I believe they're the 35s is because the tongue looks like the fives. Yeah, and they were were taking elements, whatever the number was, they would take elements from the original number. And it gets so bad. I don't say it gets so bad, but, and that's a way I want to dovetail it, because the 31s, I felt like, which came out during the Olympic Games in 2016, I want to say, somewhere around there.
I think you're right. Yeah.
That was a great aesthetically looking basketball shoe. It was a great performing looking, feeling basketball shoe. Like, that's when I was still actually playing basketball on a, you know, reasonable, you know, at a reasonable level. I'm damn near 40 now. I'm not trying to tear my ACL out here trying to be 20 years old.
I hear
again.
That.
You know what I mean?
I hear that.
So I'm curious, because like the Kyrie shoe was a good shoe. The Paul George was a great shoe. Like the KDs made my feet bleed. I hadn't told him that, but they made my, ooh, like the
stuff. That's not good.
Yeah, because he has such a narrow foot.
And it's
one of those things. So when you look at modern basketball shoes, if you are, you know, if you would even be able to recommend a modern basketball shoe, what direction would you send someone? Would you send them to Nike? Would you send them to Under Armour? Where would you send them to?
I mean, it's a good question. And it's like, you know, I always go back to like a huge percentage of basketball shoes sold are never worn to play basketball in, right? Like, people just wear them to the mall or wear them to wherever they're going. You know, so I think, unfortunately, for me to give advice, like, I'm in my 50s, so I gave up basketball even longer ago than you did. I haven't played in a while. But it's like, I don't know. I mean, for my money, it's like, what player do you like? You know, who do you want to support? Like, what do you want to wear that's different than other people are wearing? You know, like, it's funny, like, the second half of my story about the Tatums. So on my way home from us doing all this stuff at basketball courts, I stopped in Long Island at a Barnes & Noble to see if the book was there, because I hadn't seen it on the shelf yet. And like, I kind of wanted that moment of like, oh, damn, like, you can actually, someone can buy this. And I think they had like a copy. And I ended up looking through music for a while. I was looking for Dante Ross's book, which I eventually found. So I'm just standing there, and some dude is looking too, like with his girl or whatever. And he looks down at my feet. And like, looks down again and is like, yo, like, those shoes are hard. He's like, what are those? And to me, I'm like, yo, like, that's the whole thing, right? Like, I went and bought these Tatums at Dick's Sporting Goods for $120. They had like four different colors, I think. Like, I bought the black and gray ones. Like, it's kind of like an Air Jordan 4 color flip, and a little like the 14 in the cut. But it's like, I had zero difficulty buying those. Like, I went and tried them on and like just paid and left. No having to go through StockX or whatever. Right. And it's like, if you buy the most hyped up shoe possible, like the most hyped up crazy retro, anyone who looks at it is going to know what it is. Right? Like, and maybe the thought would be like, oh my God, like, you spent X amount of money for that shoe. Like, that's insane. But if you wear a current performance shoe, whether it's a Tatum or a Curry or even a KD, I think like so few people wear them, at least like in our like slightly higher age bracket. Like I can't speak for like high schoolers, but like people are going to look at those and be like, yo, like what is that? Which initially was the whole idea behind wearing a shoe. Like you wanted people to react like that. And now it's like the way to get people to react like that isn't to go spend a ton of money on whatever everyone's looking at. It's literally to just walk to your local sporting goods store, whatever it is, and buy like a current signature level product, which I understand is, this is a long-winded way of not answering your question.
No.
Know, but I'm saying like, so, and I think like there's been a bit of a basketball shoe singularity where it's like a basketball shoe now is just like a lightweight low top with decent cushioning and like a midsole plate. So like you don't get plantar fasciitis, right? Like they all have like a lot of the same elements. Mm-hmm. So I think like it is about like, who do you want to support? What do you want to support? Do you want the new Giannis with that gigantic swoosh on the side? You know, do you want the Tatum that kind of does like harken a little bit back to the 14? Like, do you want the Ja Morant? You know, do you want, yeah, Steph? Like, it's crazy too, like thinking about like writing about the Curry 1, that he's already up to 11. Yep. It doesn't feel like it's been that long.
It does not. I literally had to double take when I read that. And I was thinking, is he saying Curry 11 as in right now, or is he saying Curry 11 that's going to be there in like 3 or 4 years? And then I had to think about it. And I was like, oh, the Curry 2 was this year. And it's been X amount of years since then. And I'll tell you something else, Russ. My nephew, not my biological nephew, but like my best friend's son, when he was playing basketball and he was going and looking for shoes, he was asking for the Curry. And I was like, oh, this is it. And then the next year, a couple years later, he was asking for the Kyrie and then the Ja. And I was like, now this is a kid who's, I think my nephew's like 13 now. So back then he's the litmus test for what people are going to be into. He's not tied to what we're tied to. Like he may like a shoe that we wear, but he doesn't get it. But if he sees he sees that Kyrie shoe when Kyrie was with Nike and was still reasonably thought of, you know, maybe just as a kooky person, not over the top. And then Ja was thought as counterculture, not a criminal. Like people could attach themselves to that particular shoe, to that particular brand. And even with Steph before the Curry 2s came out, the white Curry 2s that came out during 2016?
The Steph Curry's, yeah.
And nobody liked them. Everybody thought they were like some orthopedic shoes. Everybody looked at them like,
right.
These ain't it. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. Like, it's funny, Russ, I want to dovetail really quickly because I have two more things for you. Skechers is making a move into getting basketball players. Julius Randle, Joel Embiid. It's really hard for big men to sell shoes if your name isn't Charles Barkley. Like, let's be perfectly honest. And that has so much more to do with Charles Barkley, the personality, than Charles Barkley, the basketball player, even though Charles Barkley, the basketball player, was freaking incredible. Like, but what do you think of these not traditional basketball brands jumping into the basketball market?
I think it's interesting, you know, and I think like a company like Skechers, which obviously is a massive company, like doesn't do that unless they see like an opening there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's funny that you brought up, you know, a 13-year-old being into that current stuff. And like, I used to live pretty close to a high school, and like sometimes I would watch like, you know, kids walking up the block or whatever. And it's like so many of them would be wearing like current shoes. This was a couple of years ago, so it was like Kyrie's and KD's and Curry's. And I think like kids, you know, especially like that sort of junior high, maybe beginning of high school, like before they get indoctrinated by people our age into like, oh, yo, these are classics or whatever, like they want that current stuff. Like they want what they see guys wearing. Like they're a big Steph Curry. Big Steph Curry fan or a big Kyrie fan. And like, if you watch basketball, like, of course you are. So it's like, you want those shoes. And, you know, that's the way we wanted stuff back then. It's like, we watched Jordan, like you wanted the new Air Jordan. You watched Charles Barkley. You wanted the Barkley. Like, I feel like that's like actually a healthy way to be and like a good way to be, you know? And I think like back when that stuff was popping off, like, we were the ones setting the trends. The younger kids, like, it was like, yo, these are cool. And our parents were like, well, what are you talking about? Like, we're not spending that kind of money, or like, why is that important? Now we're the age of our parents, but we insist on still being the ones to say, like, nah, this is cool. And to me, it's like, it's that Principal Skinner meme, right? It's like, nah, it's the kids who were wrong. It's like, nah, like, I think a bunch of us need to take a step back and be like, yo, let the kids run it. You know, and I want to bring it back for a second to, like, because I thought about it some more, like what you said with, like, what would you recommend? Honestly, like, I would recommend, like, get in on the ground floor of the new stuff. Get the ones, you know, like, to me, it's like the Tatum one, the John Morant one, even the Anthony Edwards, right? Like, I don't even know if I like the Anthony Edwards shoe. I saw that and I'm like, I don't know, man, like that whole like synthetic material up the side and like it doesn't have stripes on it, except that sort of equipment style logo on the back. But like, I don't know, like to me, the new stuff is cool and the new stuff should be given even a pass just on the strength of being cool. I mean, I'm not being cool. I'm being new.
Right.
You know, like I'm going to, yo, when they release, I'm going to go look at that Skechers basketball shoe that, Julius
the
Embiid, is wearing.
The Embiid one doesn't look bad.
I'm curious about it.
That Embiid one doesn't look bad. I don't know if I'd buy it, but I'm not looking at it like, oh my God, this is a monstrosity. It doesn't look like what you would say is a traditional Skechers shoe. You know what I mean?
But to me, it's like, and that kind of goes to the book too, right? Because the book obviously is in chronological order. The book, I touch on retro in the epilogue because I don't think you can like ignore it. But like back then, for basically the entire history of basketball and sneakers, the new stuff was the coolest stuff, period. And I think, you know, it's almost like there's so much noise out there now. I think if you adopt that and you say, like, I'm going to get this new thing, even if I don't know that much about it, and even if I don't necessarily love it, but I'm going to get it because it's the new thing. And it's like, it's going to kind of tie me to this current time. You know, I look at another shoe that I unfortunately didn't have room to really get into too much, the Foamposite One.
Yeah.
When that came out in 97, that shoe was wild expensive. It was completely different from everything. It weighed 1,000,000 pounds. Like that shoe is insanely heavy. Did I love that shoe when it came out? You know, not necessarily, but if you wore the Foamposite early, yo, like you blew everybody's mind. Like nobody knew what was going on if you wore that shoe. And I think like if you look at something like the AE1, that kind of is in that same vein where like if you wear a pair of Jordan 1s, you're just wearing Jordan 1s, right? Like even if you have fragments, even if you have whatever, the average person especially is going to look at whatever Jordan 1s you have on and be like, oh, it's Jordan 1s. So what? And if you have to sit and explain, like, no, but this is a special thing and they only made 500 and like they sell for $3,000, like, oh, who cares? Shut up.
Right.
But if you wear like the AE1, or I'm trying to think of even, I think that's probably the most impactful one, or Sabrina, say the Sabrina one.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you wear those around, people are going to be like, yo, what is that? And in part is because people are so caught up in retro.
Right.
But in part also it's because like that new stuff doesn't carry sort of the same cultural cachet anymore. And I feel like it should.
Yeah. It's an interesting, like every year I go through and I say, okay, I'm going to play more basketball this year and I'm going to buy a basketball shoe. Like I go through the mental exercise of doing that.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, I'm like, dude, you have a job to, like, if you break your knee, you're going to go and tell your employer, yeah, I was trying to relive my days when I was 25 again. You know what I mean? Like, now I got to have surgery. But even just the imagination of those particular shoes, of going through the process, the mental process of it, and you're like, these are like Devin Booker. Like, he's got a signature shoe. Those remind me so much of the Kobe shoes. Those remind me of Kobe being kind of a revolutionary in a way. And you spoke of so much of that in the book of Kobe's like, strip it down. If it doesn't make sense for the shoe, I don't care about the style. Give me the shoe first, and then we can make it stylish after that. And I felt like that became the trendsetter for, you know, for the way that basketball performance shoes are made today. And maybe people don't realize that that's what it is. But Kobe, and maybe that story, that mythology would have been told more had Kobe still been alive today, as opposed to the grand mythology of Kobe Bryant as a human being and as a figure, you know, given everything since his passing. Like, I feel like we're missing a part of that where the past could be tied to the future and people could embrace, you know, the future a little bit more. But I guess just last thing, because we're so much of this sounds like two old men, you know, yelling at Cloud. But what do you love about the sneaker culture as a whole?
Man, that's a tough question. I mean, look, I do love that, you know, a lot of stuff that was, you know, how should I say this? Like, it's cool that a lot of stuff I did think was cool as a kid has been, like, affirmed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the Air Jordan 3 or whatever, like, which was the first Jordan I really, like, super, super, super lusted after. I mean, I wanted the ones, but the threes were like, oh, my God. You know, it's been affirmed and reaffirmed again and again that, like, yeah, this stuff is valid. You know, I think, like, just the and the overall thing that, like, yo, sneakers are actually important. You know, sneakers are a cool thing that people should pay attention to. You know, that's kind of been validated again and again and again, too. You know, I guess my thing is still just, like, instead of just constantly churning the past, and constantly being like, oh, here's another Jordan 3. Here's another, you know, whatever you want it to be. Here's another Adidas rivalry or another Adidas Kobe. You know, I feel like we've lost sight to, and not to harp on it, but like of the fact that the new stuff was always cool. And the old stuff is nice and it's fun to revisit. But like the new stuff should be what's driving everything. And, you know, that's kind of fallen off. And I would like to see it come back to that a little bit. You know, I guess it doesn't help that like those running like super shoes you basically can't wear unless you're running.
Yeah.
So it's like you're not going to buy those $500 Adidas like Adios, whatever they are, to just wear casually. You know, I would like to see basketball shoes get a little more. Like you said about the 35, right? They included the reflective tongue, like. The 36 had the little wing on the back and stuff. And like, to me, instead of incorporating elements of past shoes, I would rather see them like, be like, wait, but why did this resonate? You know, instead of like, if you put the reflective 5 in the 35, that's all well and good. And like, yeah, people connect it. But if they have the choice between the 35 and the 5, they're just going to buy the 5.
Right.
Because the 5's still available. Like, make the current stuff more compelling. And, you know, to me, it's more like, I don't know, like if I was just getting into shoes right now, it would be really hard, I feel like, too. You know, you walk into a sneaker store or you look online somewhere and you just get overwhelmed. Like, it's so much stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot.
You know, and people are so insistent on like, oh, you have to own this or you have to own that. And it's like, I guess for me, it's like, yo, like, no, you don't. You don't have to own anything. Like, figure out what you like and like, don't worry about the rest of it. You know, and maybe that seems insane to say, like I wrote an entire book about like these certain sneakers that are important. And I do think they are, but it's kind of like that whole, like, well, I forget whether it was in a Bruce Lee movie or some sort of Hong Kong, like, don't look at the finger pointing at the moon. You'll miss all the heavenly glory. You know, it's like, it's the moon that's the attention. It's not the point. Like, don't get so caught up in like what shoes were big in the past and miss the present. Cause the present's the fun part.
The present.
Like to me, it's like give the current stuff a chance.
Yep.
And give the current stuff a chance.
Give them a chance to become classic. Give them a chance because they will become classic if we let it.
And it becomes self-fulfilling either way. If you look at it and say like, oh, this doesn't matter. Well, then it doesn't matter because no one ends up wearing it. Like be the person who says like, I'm just going to wear new stuff.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Russ Bankston. Russ, you're author of A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. I really, really appreciate the time today, man. You gave us so many gems. It's so many stories in there that we couldn't get to. You got to go in, even though it's stories that people might know, like the story about Michael Jordan possibly leaving Nike after the Air Jordan 2, and then they come up with, boom, this Jordan 3. And everything else is not just the 15 sneakers. It's the evolution of the sneakers. It's the history of basketball there. It goes back even from before Nike's basketball shoes didn't start with Nike. It's the Pumas. It's the Adidas. It's the Reeboks. Right. It's so much more. Russ, I really appreciate you giving me so much of your time, man. Go and buy that book. Thanks again, man.
Thank you, man. Anytime. Really appreciate it.
Hey, appreciate you, man. I'm going to have him on again to actually talk some actual basketball in the future because he's a New Yorker and they have plenty of misery to talk about. So go buy the book. And thanks to producer John for, of course, setting this up. Evan and Ron also behind the glass with the videos. Dan Devine will be back this week for another episode of Devine Intervention tomorrow. I will have a solo episode on Wednesday. Until then, everybody, be safe.